Welcome to the Indie Dev Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Voiles. Lyriad Games is an independent studio based across three continents. Realizing that WebGL isn't just a pipe dream, they've already built two games on it. Their latest game, Age of Ascent, is built on a custom WebGL engine and is using Azure as a backend with the ability to scale up to 50,000 concurrent users. Joining me tonight are CTO Ben Adams and CEO James Niswan. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me tonight.
Thanks very much for having us, Dave.
All right.
Thank you very much for having us.
So where are you two hailing out of at the moment?
Well, I'm actually in Florida, East Coast, just up the road from Cape Canaveral. Despite my accent, it's not a particularly local Floridian accent. But it's a nice part of the world to live.
As I said, it's something to throw some people off when they hear the British accent coming from South Florida. For their older New Yorkers.
As they say down here, the newlywed and nearly dead.
Exactly. That's the truth. And then, Ben, how about yourself?
I'm in Nottingham in Robin Hood County. In the rainy at the moment, UK, British South.
Every time I hear Nottingham, I can't help but think of Robin Hood and Sherlock, so... But then again, I'm from New York, so what do I know?
When I moved here, I mean, obviously I knew Robin Hood and Nottingham, but it did take me a year, I think about a year and a half, to realize it was that Nottingham. And I was wondering why all the streets were named things like Maid Marian Way.
That's great. So did you two meet or get together before James had left the UK or what?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I met Ben through my wife. Ben and my wife worked together at Experian, I think best known as the credit card agency, but they do a lot of CRM and marketing. Credit reference agency, yeah.
Yes.
They were colleagues there, and that's how I met Ben and persuaded him to leave his well-paid, safe job. And,
why don't you work on video games for a while?
Plunge into an indie video game, yeah.
That's a big, very big change, huh?
Just a little bit.
Yeah, but I guess you were doing a lot of programming with numbers at Experian, so it kind of makes sense that you make the logical transition over to web or WebGL at least.
In terms of technologies... I mean, it's not too much of a departure. Obviously, content is quite...
Yes.
Quite,
but math is math.
Yeah, and the aesthetics between a business app and a game is slightly different.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, an MMO is all about processing and transmitting and receiving the largest amount of data you possibly can in as short a period of time as you can. And that's not entirely dissimilar from what the big corps like Experian do.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, James sold me on the come be your own boss, but little did I know that we'd have thousands of players here and now my boss.
scales just as much as the players do.
Yeah. Why can't I have that tomorrow? Yesterday, rather.
Yeah, the petition queue. Support petition tickets. Oh, yay.
right? Because then you owe... Yeah, exactly. The players are your boss because they're the ones footing your bill and writing your checks, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So, and they're hard taskmasters, I tell you.
That's right. The players are always the hardest ones to please.
And they always want things that conflict with each other.
So. Exactly. clearly you've had some experience before you started in Age of Ascent, so why don't we take a step back and explain how you got into games or game development for each of you, and then how the studio got formed.
For me, it's probably best described as a gigantic midlife crisis. I was a Middle East specialist out of university, and that sort of focused in that area. And then I joined a dot-com era startup in the travel industry.
Okay.
Doing internet travel stuff that was very successful. We ended up on the London Stock Exchange, and we got bought by Travelocity and merged into
that's
the
huge.
Yeah, absolutely. Got sort of merged into the big Saber Travelocity conglomerate.
Yep.
At which point I quit and I sort of rattled around a bit thinking, well, what do I want to do now? You know, I've gone from the Middle East to dot-com travel. What do I want to do with the rest of my life? And it was kind of, you know, either buy a red Porsche or a, you know, start a games company. So,
hey,
so
either way, it's a good decision.
Yeah, well, I'm not so sure about the Porsche. Yeah. And actually, starting a games company, is, you know, as an indie, there's very little chance that you'll be getting a Porsche.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Yeah, yeah.
You could be the next, you know, John Romero or John Carmack. You don't know.
Oh, you never know. You never know. Yeah, live in hope. Yeah. So, yeah, so I sort of, knowing nothing about it, it was a sort of fairly late night, fairly well-oiled conversation with a bunch of friends. And we were all sort of bemoaning the lack of anything truly epic in the strategy genre. This is about sort of 2008, 2009.
Okay.
And I sort of resolved quite drunkenly to start my own company and write my own game.
Right.
And I'm not really a programmer. I mean, I think Ben will be the first person to second that.
Ben, enough experience playing games.
A lot of experience playing games, and I've, you know, I was one of those sort of quite geeky kids, I guess. You know, I designed my own sort of Dungeons and Dragons type game system when I was like 16 and stuff. So I've always been quite geeky, so I just sort of built a prototype, basically, which I wrote the entire game language in Microsoft SQL Server. The whole game was written in Transact SQL as the engine, because I couldn't program anything else. And it was classic ASP on the front end. And I showed it to Ben, and amazingly, he didn't run a mile. I still quite to this day don't know why he didn't run for the hills. But he sort of basically said, look, I'm going to take the code away from you now. You know, you must stop writing this. It's a affront to humanity, he decided to sort of he started. I think actually, Ben, you can pick it up from here, really.
Well, you still do a lot of SQL, although I do get emails going. I tried to change this function. What witchery is this?
Yeah.
I suppose from that point, I decided I couldn't really work with classic ASP for much longer. Too, it's
probably obscure. The best idea for games, right?
No, it's an obscure way of telling you something was wrong.
Especially when you look at like some of the games James had listed off before, right? We have another interview I'd read. It was Dune 2, Civ, Alpha Centauri.
Oh, totally.
Echelon's Call, which I thought was the only person to ever play.
Oh no! Asheron's Call was more Ben's game than mine, I think.
Oh really? But,
yeah.
No, Asheron's Call player.
I played a lot of that too.
I mean that's our list of classic games. You know, it's Civ 3, Dune 2, Elite, Freelancer,
Ultima,
Asheron's Call. Yeah, absolutely. You know, great epic games. I love grand strategy. You know, it's one of my real passions. I was about to say. So I've you know, persuaded Ben to quit his job and come on board. And because we had my sort of badly functioning prototype to work as a sort of work towards improving, we managed to get the game out in about 8 months. This version, the sort of first version of the game. I think we're now on version 4.
Illyriad,
the eponymously named title. Just so everyone knows, we call the Illyriad games, but we also have our first game is called Illyriad, which is
album thing going on.
Yeah, what a terrible mistake that is, because you're stuck with that name forever.
That's right, and search engines love you.
yeah, absolutely. We got that out in, I think we launched it 2010, it sort of launched, February 2010, and...
what was this built on at the time? Did you use WebGL back then as well? Or?
No, this is pre-WebGL, this was, Ben had moved us into sort of MVC, .NET type stuff.
I mean, we launched on Classic ASP, and it was HTML4.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And James had lured me in on. I just need some progress bars that work with JavaScript.
Actually, I just did some of those about a year ago.
It was a slippery slope from there.
And then converted it all to ASP.NET and MVC.
Yeah.
Was the first.
Although the back end of Illyriad still runs in Transact SQL. The game engine is stored procedures. And I know, don't look so shocked. it genuinely is. It's the server loop is a eternally recursive looping stored procedure. That's what drives the game. Mm-hmm. So it's an unusual way of doing it, but again, on a sort of quite slow paced, persistent world real time strategy game.
Yeah.
Having the code with great proximity to the data does give some quite good advantages as well.
Definitely.
We're certainly not doing Age of Ascent that way.
No, that'd be quite a bit of work.
It would be a lot of work, yeah.
Well, no, I have no idea how we scale it sideways.
Yeah, there is that too. Over the sort of last, it'll be 5 years now in February. Illyriad will be 5 years old.
People seem to love it. I mean, just looking on Google Play alone, you guys have an average of 4.5 rating. So,
yeah. Yeah, no, it's a successful, popular, critically acclaimed, award winning. We were online innovation finalists at the Develop Awards last year for Illyriad, not Age of Ascent, because Age of Ascent hasn't been released yet.
Right.
We lost to Peter Molyneux, which I guess there's no shame in
losing
to him. Yeah. it's been very successful and it continues to be. And because it's a persistent world and we don't do server resets,
yep.
We have to come out with a lot of new content as often as we possibly can. Mm-hmm. And we have to build a system where, one of our sort of game mantras in terms of our design philosophy is that there is no content that we can create as game designers that is as compelling as the content that the players themselves create.
Yeah, definitely. Many minds thinking together is going to get a lot more productivity.
Yeah, absolutely. So, it's a game that focuses quite strongly on alliances and social aspects mm-hmm. of cooperative and competitive gameplay between players.
I'm noticing the initial file size, it's wild how small it is. It's 25 kilobytes if you go to download it through Google Play.
Yeah. Well, I think the Google Play one is pretty much just a window into the game. World. But yeah. Because we're HTML5, we believe in incredibly thin clients.
Definitely.
You can play Illyriad on your and people do on their mobile phones
and
tablets. And, yeah, absolutely. And being HTML5, you can generally code once and have it cross-platform.
Some tweaks here and there, but
They always have. There are. It's never quite as easy as it should be. But we do involve ourselves quite heavily in the standards bodies, like the W3C committees and the Kronos Group and that sort of stuff. So we're sort of quite heavily involved in trying to set the standards and get them fully adopted by everyone.
Yeah.
Because it helps us as well as everyone else.
Oh, yeah. No, mm-hmm. I'm sure. And, that's the joy of working on a large... I don't know if you'd consider it open source. Perhaps it is. Actually it is, because you can contribute and send pull requests. So, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, like you said, the fact that so many people can openly contribute to this large graphics project, in the end, works to benefit everybody.
Yeah, quite. And we're very keen to welcome player plugins and enhancements. If you go to the Chrome Store or something and you look for Illyriad, you'll also find there's a downloadable plugins like Illyriad Helper. That's nothing to do with us. It's just been written by someone who needed, much more advanced scheduling and a different sort of way of laying the whole thing out and a whole different UI. And that's great. We think that's awesome. We're fully supportive of players who want to customize the experience and distribute it to other people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of the things about, as you say, it's only it's a very small download. But since we serve everything from the server, it does mean we regularly do updates on the fly. We've only had about, I think, one day downtime when we switched hosts, and we've done like 1,000 updates, and everybody just picks them up as they're
like right there. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that makes updating the game and patching it just so easy. And we get an average of sort of one patch out every 3 or 4 days, patch mm-hmm. or content update,
it's
which
like
again,
transparent.
completely transparent. No one has to do anything. It just goes live.
Yeah. Yeah, we're a little different from what we have right now in some other regards. I mean, there was some... Okay, we had Halo come out a couple weeks ago, right? And a patch for 10 gigabytes.
That's just not our way of doing things. You know, we like to keep it as simple as possible because I have to say it helps our sanity as well. I mean, having said that, you know, WebGL, I think Ben would probably be the first to agree, has not been the easiest path because
it's in its infancy,
and we've had to genuinely learn everything there is to know about quaternions from scratch, not just the formulas, you know.
Like you're saying,
just
like gimbal lock and things like
that. Oh, yeah, absolutely. But, there's a whole bunch of sort of 1800s, you know, the early mid-19th century maths that everyone's forgotten. Yeah. But actually, it's really useful.
Yeah.
So we've sort of been, you know, poring over, you know, the 1967 works of the Quaternion Society, you know, just to sort of bring ourselves up to date with how things could be done and, you know, because when you're dealing with something like the scale of Age of Ascent, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a minute, but you know the speed of computation is absolutely paramount for us.
Every byte is going to matter, right?
Every single byte, every single bit. I mean, we have bit meetings once every couple of weeks where the developers have to argue and passionately explain and defend why they need a particular bit in a package. In any kind of application message packet, because in our world, an extra bit in a message is 9 megaseconds of bandwidth at the scale that we're running at. So when we did our stress test in March this year, we went up to 50,000 players in a single single combat arena.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were processing, I think, Ben, it was 267 million application messages a second. You know,
and we thought Twitter had some traffic.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I think we were knocking Twitter's figures, their monthly figures out every hour. You know, it was like, it was really quite special. And that's, you know, useful application messages. That's not just TCP overhead. It's the whole position updates and bullets being fired and stuff like that. And, you know, at that scale, it's the computational cycles that and the hoops you have to go through. Every millisecond, every microsecond is critical.
So, you know, before we get too technical, which I do want to do, why don't we take a step back and explain what Age of Ascent is? This way people can have a visualization as we're going along with the technical nitty-gritty.
Yeah, absolutely. Age of Ascent is our forthcoming title, scheduled for release towards the end of next year. It is an HTML5 WebGL browser-based space epic. It is real-time direct piloting combat. It is a full-fledged MMO in all the ways that one would normally expect, including industry and commerce, mission running and the like, with faction, NPCs, AI. But it's very, very focused around the player, player versus player, and you know, as many people as possible into the world. And we built it from the ground up to run in on the Azure platform, using, you know, quite a lot of quite advanced network techniques and methods of handling that kind of volume and traffic capabilities.
Yeah.
But we run a free public demo of it every second Saturday. The next one is the Saturday 14th, I think, and then obviously there'll be one at the end of the year, where anyone can just pitch up, just bring a browser and a web connection, and you're straight into the game, fighting PvP in space with however many other people around the world turn up. It can be anything from 20 people to 200, 300, and it's just a lot of fun. It's a blast, but it's a good demo of the technology.
Yeah. Definitely. I think it sells both parts really, really well.
Absolutely. And so whilst we've got that sort of PvP element functioning and running and testable, we're sort of now spending all of our dev time on the back end, the other stuff, you know, mining, industry, manufacture, ship loadouts, those sort of things.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess to the outsider, what is the closest competition right now? Is it EVE Online or something of that nature?
Yeah, probably. I think EVE Online is probably the closest competition because there are some other upcoming titles like Elite Dangerous and Star Citizen. Right.
Yes.
And they're going to be fantastic. We're really looking forward to them. But they're not super multiplayer in the sense that we are. You know, and even EVE, you know, yes, EVE can have 4,000 spaceships in a battle. You know, these huge battles. But it's not a direct piloting game. You're not actually flying a spaceship.
You're kind of sending some commands, you know? Sitting back and
watching. Exactly. Yeah. Whereas we are. This is
you're a like Twitch. Wing Commander for the new generation.
Yeah, basically. If you can imagine a 50,000 player. Battle in Freelancer, that's kind of where we are. Yes. We have some limitations, obviously, because we're distributing over the web. We need everything to be fairly, in terms of textures, they have to be quite low. We have to have low poly counts. We can't do anything like the detail and the beauty of some of those, box set games. But
object pooling down to a science.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but you know, in a sort of Twitch-based combat game, do you really care if your turrets don't track and animate in real time?
Right.
Some people do, and
you've
that's
got so
that's
much
cool.
Going on, you're probably not looking.
Yeah, good. Yeah. It's you know, we think the gameplay is the biggest sort of differentiator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How many people are working at the studio at this moment? Because right now it sounds like a huge and grand scale because. You have to write an engine from scratch using WebGL, which is still in its infancy. You have a whole cloud backend you had to build together. I mean, we're talking like 20 or 30 employees here, or 5 or 6?
5 or 6. In fact, it's 4 or 5 at the moment. And that includes the two of us. So it is a tiny team. Having said that, you know, we've written the WebGL end, and that's what we demo. Obviously, there's still more to do, but yeah. It's now in terms of
the
more
possible
effects, and yeah, absolutely. But you know, the core of it works. We've written the networking infrastructure, which is again probably the biggest headache, and that's all done. So you know, now it's filling all the remainder of the game. You know, the kind of the spreadsheets in space bit. We've already done that with Illyriad because Illyriad has a fully functioning economy and a crafting system and all the rest of it. So
bring a lot of that over.
We can share a lot of our learnings, our knowledge, and share quite a lot of the common code that is common to all MMOs. For example, payment handling systems, or chat, or alliance management, or in-game mail. You know, these systems have a very common functionality, and we just need to sort of cloudify them.
Yeah, I mean, like, just the technology itself is worth some money, considering how much time and energy you've invested in that.
Well, I hope so. Yeah. If there are any venture capitalists out there listening, desperate.
That's right, yeah. It's it's difficult to replicate at this point, and that's why so few are doing it.
Yeah, it's been a hell of a journey, to be honest. And I think everyone thought we were mad. You know, when we first began talking to people about what we wanted to do, A lot of people that we were talking to just laughed. They said, "Yeah, right. No one can do that. That this isn't possible. You can't have 50,000 people all giving their button mashing input and their mouse control points and all fighting in the same combat arena. That's just a Mishagos nightmare."
Yeah, there's nothing that's even remotely close to it at this point.
No.
And a few games that do try to scale largely do it in instancing, like World of Warcraft handles it, correct?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And there's nothing wrong with instancing or rest of it, but it does limit the sort of the grand scale of the game. Now, we're not saying that there will always be 50,000 player combats going on. Space is huge.
It has the ability to scale.
Exactly. And it will scale dynamically. So if Alliance A want to fight Alliance B and the whole thing snowballs, there shouldn't come a point where the server says, there are too many people in the system, no one else can come in.
Right.
You know, or time dilation, which is, I think, how EVE handles it, which is, you know, they slow down the server clock.
Yeah, no, exactly. Especially when they have large scale battles.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I absolutely love EVE. I was quite a notable pilot. I'm in the EVEpedia. There's a CCP put an entry in for my character. I'm not going to tell anyone who it is, but
next person the pirates come after.
Yeah, exactly. There'll be a bounty on my head, but I've got a lot of love for EVE. I mean, it's a fantastic game. I've played a lot. It's just, you know, we're doing something different, and that's cool. There's room in the market for as many entrants, I think. I don't think anyone's going to begrudge another space game.
No. And I think once people understand, wrap their heads around what a great PvP experience can be like when you have that many people, I think they'll jump on board. I mean, in particular, I used to play Warhammer Online. I loved it. But the issue was that once you had more than, say, 30 or 40 people on either side going at it, the game came to a complete halt. So on one hand, like, the experience was incredible because there's so many different classes and characters going at it and strategies, but it just turned into a mess. And that's 100 people. So.
Yeah, absolutely. But I do find it quite strange. And if you look back, you know, 15 years ago and look back at Freelancer, you know, it was released in, 2001, 2002, that game could support 128 players, if I remember correctly. You know, on a network LAN battle, or even on an internet battle, it's kind of where I do sometimes wonder where everyone's ambition went. You know, if that was running 15 years ago, where did everyone?
I know. And I just went through Wing Commander: Heart of the Tiger and Wing Commander 4 earlier this year, probably around February. And I had these when I was younger, but I just couldn't get it. And as I got older, I started playing it again. I thought, this is amazing. I need something like this again. And then I. Stumbled across your game at an internal Microsoft event in the summer, and I saw the one of your developers giving a talk about it, and I understood like what you were trying to do with the scale and scope of both WebGL and Azure, and immediately like everyone in the room was enamored because this is technology that we're all working with, and you know it's great to see it actually being pushed forward for once instead of kind of being rested and brought to the side.
Oh, well, thank you. I really appreciate that. You know, a lot of people talk about cloud gaming and what cloud gaming means, and actually it means totally different things to different people.
Absolutely.
I was speaking at a conference called Cloud Gaming in San Francisco last month, and no one was talking about what I believe cloud gaming is. Everyone was talking about streaming games over the internet. So, you know, you'd have your dumb terminal, and then you'd connect off to a PlayStation, and it would send the
like
visuals back.
Services
exactly. And that's what the entire conference was about. I was the only one actually talking about running a game over the internet as opposed to streaming video.
Right, because the way they're looking at it is, right, they want the server to actually do all the CPU and utilization and then just spit out video to you, right?
Yeah.
But I want that to get there at some point, but the latency for that is still too large, I think, for most people to understand. I mean, even Steam in-home streaming still struggles with it above anything, above 720p.
Yeah. Well, the latency's high, and you also get the bandwidth costs for the company running it. It makes it pretty difficult for them to make a profit. You know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I worked at Comcast writing video codecs and things like that, and I mean, just the amount of compression you have to do, push across the line, and then decompress it in real time once it gets there, like those huge costs on both sides.
Yeah.
So it's tough. It is a tough gig. So you guys are doing on your side is impressive.
Well, thank you. Well, we're relying on the client's web browser and the client's graphics card to do all the really heavy lifting.
Yeah.
I mean, I say that. I mean, obviously, we've still got to handle 267 billion messages, right. So there's quite a lot of heavy lifting at our end too.
Yeah.
But you know, we're spreading that out over the entirety of the Azure infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
So when we did our test, we were running. I think it was one or two data centers in the U.S.
No, three. We were West U.S., East U.S., and Europe.
Okay, so try to keep the latency down for all these people.
Absolutely. Yeah, everyone connects into their local one, yeah.
Yeah, right, because it's trying to find like the closest endpoint to kind of speak to, because the data is replicated across all three servers and kind of give it to you there. So instead of, you know, the San Francisco residents trying to hit an endpoint in Europe, they can just speak to the local, you know, server in wherever the Bay Area or that one is talking to it.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah. So on the client side, what is the client device actually doing for people who aren't familiar with all this web technology? I mean, are they running it in a browser? Do they have to download an executable? Not everyone's aware of how this works.
Sure. Ben, do you want to pick that one up?
Well, it literally is. You click a URL in a web browser, and the game loads up almost immediately,
mm-hmm.
and then you're in there with, you know, mouse and button mashing straight away. I mean, you enter a name so you can display your name to other players, and start recording you on the leaderboard. But that's it. You're straight into the game.
There's no download. There's no install. There's no plugins. No flash. No Silverlight. Nothing. It's just native in the browser. I think a lot of people don't necessarily. I haven't really heard that much about WebGL yet. I think a lot of people have played with some of the Chrome experiments, like that human body one, or
using WebSockets.
Exactly. You know, there's been a few sort of examples and great examples of WebGL, you know, working. But I don't think anyone's really done a huge WebGL game yet. At least, I mean, you know, there have been some, but there's nothing that's really sort of leapt out, I think, at people.
Right. And the thing with WebGL is that with web pages in particular, generally you are CPU bound, right? Because JavaScript is what is talking to the CPU and single threaded all in the UI thread. You're having to handle all this. But with WebGL, it's basically an OpenGL, a fork of OpenGL ES, right? The mobile version of OpenGL that works in the browser, which then allows you to write JavaScript and shader code, which talks directly to the pipeline and the graphics card, right?
Yeah, completely. And so the GPU is handling most of the calculations, and that's, you know, that's a pretty powerful thing on. You know, it's the equivalent to your desktop or
There really is no difference at all at that point. And
you're not comparing JavaScript performance,
right? So all of a sudden, that whole issue of JavaScript being CPU bound and that being the bottleneck, it kind of throws it out the window. And previously, browsers were hesitant to adopt it, but I think now with the latest updates, you see latest versions of Android has it as of November. The latest versions of iOS have it as well in Safari, but Safari and Chrome finally just kicked it into gear as well. But a lot of the browsers are kind of supporting it in different ways at this point. So there is a standard through the Kronos group, right? But or the WC3,
through the web support.
So it's getting there, but I think with time, like, especially now that it works on basically all the major mobile devices, and time goes on, I think we'll really start to see adoption.
I mean, at the moment, it's probably the most widely deployed 3D, consistently 3D engine, 3D system across anything, really, because it is now in every browser, all the mobile platforms. And it's probably the most, it has the most conformance tests. It's probably the most tested graphics platform as well.
Had you considered a different engine or framework or anything before you jumped into WebGL?
No. we're totally HTML5 open standards people. Yeah. That's what we do.
Right.
And before that, our only real option, if we were going to do it in the browser, was Flash. And I'd rather push needles in my eye.
Yeah.
Yeah. Flash, there's the Unity plugin, but.
Well, I think Steve Jobs and Apple killed Flash a few years ago.
Yeah. Well, one of the greatest things he ever did, I think.
So, another thing that grabbed my eye when listening to the talk I'd heard was, like you mentioned about, conserving bits here and there. So, I didn't have a computer science degree from school. I kind of learned it on my own as I went along, and a lot of this education I missed out from not going to school, and it made me really wish that I had sat in a school at some point and learned the nitty gritty of all this programming. So do you want to get in any detail of maybe an absurd story on how you had to save a bit here or there, or are you using one specific type, like an int instead of a float in an instance, anything like that?
As I say, the bit meetings get very, very heated sometimes, because at the end of the day, you generally want as much precision as possible. So we find interesting and unusual ways of binding up. Instead of sending, for example, lots of position updates, you could send a description of a graph curve in three dimensions, and that then rather than actually. Giving continuous updates, you could describe something as an arc, and that's suitable for stuff like missiles or stuff like drones. Those kind of work very well. We fight over these bits, because as I say, it's one bit is 9 megasecond, and that obviously as a company we have to sort of swallow the bandwidth costs, and so it's not only it makes the code lighter and faster, and also keeps us very honest in terms of never wasting a single line of code or a single bit in a message packet. Mm-hmm. It keeps the code very, very tight. It's very old school, this. I mean, WebGL is pretty old school. There aren't that many libraries out there. There aren't that many good tutorials on how to implement WebGL. Yeah,
it's still a very, very small community.
It is a small community, and that's great because, you know, you can be part of it and you can help influence it and steer it in different directions and contribute back to, you know, all your learnings to other people.
That's really making a difference.
Yeah, which, you know, is very important to us. You know, we're on the W3C ORTC, the real time chat committee. You know, we sort of really believe in not only for our own benefit but for the benefit of the web community as a whole,
right.
and hopefully for the internet in general. Without sounding too altruistic, you know, obviously we're a company as well, so it benefits us too.
There's
no doubt about that. But yeah, at the tech side, you know, it is very old school. This, it's kind of, you know, like we're programming back in the 1980s again. You know,
yeah.
Where you know, you're limited. You've only got 16K of RAM in your machine. You know,
yes.
Make a game out of that. Well, and you say something like that, but you know, the BBC Model B, the Acorn computer with 32K of RAM, ran Elite. You know, which is one of the most fantastic space games ever.
Well, they made it happen. If you look at have you read the book on Racing the Beam, where they talk about, you know, how they were basically drawing graphics for the original Atari, for even things like Pitfall, right?
And they
go into great detail about how they, you know, have to draw the sprite for the swinging rope, and essentially you're trying to manipulate the pixel before the Atari can refresh the entire screen from the top to bottom.
Yeah, exactly. And so you get with all these sort of very old school and very old techniques for small minor workarounds. Yeah. And, you know, the beauty is that they still run today. But, you know, the whole Age of Ascent client, I mean, Ben, what's the client size roughly?
It's about 9 megs, I think.
It's 9 megs.
And that's including all the graphics.
That's including all the graphics, all the textures, everything. Everything except the audio, I think.
Holy.
Oh, yeah, I don't.
We don't count the audio in that.
We stream that.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. So then, in terms of like your back end, what does it look like? How are you using the cloud? What are you doing with Azure?
Oh, I'll definitely pass that one to Ben. I only see it as diagrams.
Warming them up little by little.
I think we use practically everything.
You have VMs going in there, you're hosting the website, mobile services for messaging queues or service bus.
No, authentication. We do, so we use Traffic Manager, which is the, enables, somebody comes in, connects, and it does the DNS resolution to find the closest point to you, so we can connect you to your closest data center, for the lowest latency.
Okay.
And then that goes into the platform as a service that we actually host the game engine in, and that enables us, you know, just to drag a slider when we need to scale up. And it's all pre-configured.
And we're using Katana as our web service, HTML, HTTP handler.
Yeah, we run on the worker roles for that. But then we use websites for, you know, just sort of everything else, for, you know, displaying web pages, and we're going to use that for the spreadsheets in space as is.
And that can add up too. I mean, just serving that to thousands of people at a time.
Yeah, it certainly can.
Yeah, and it's amazing to think like what this infrastructure previously would have cost you if you had to stand up all these servers beforehand, right?
Well, I mean. Previously, you'd had to work out what exactly it was you need, and you couldn't. You'd have to go buy it, and if it was sitting idle, you'd still be paying for it. And the cloud gives us, you know, I need to do a massive test of, you know, thousands and thousands of players simulated.
Yeah,
I spin it up, you know, run it for 10 minutes, turn it off, and I've only paid for 10 minutes.
You're essentially only paying for what you use at that point, right?
Yeah, exactly, and by the minute pricing. So, you know, I can run 700 servers for a minute, and that just costs, I don't know, a couple of hours of one server.
Yeah, exactly.
yeah, it's great. I mean, when we did our 50,000 player test, we spooled up, I think, it was about 260 servers, Ben.
Yeah, 700 cores. Okay.
700 cores.
And you had like a PowerShell script for all this, or was one guy sitting there turning on these things button by button?
in the testing, it was you know, manually pressing.
But, oh man!
But when we did the big test, we moved to PowerShell, and you know, it had all the checks and testing, and
you kind of automated that way.
Yeah, it got a bit frantic. I think we had one test where it wasn't working about 5 minutes before, and James was.
I was pulling my hair out. I was having kittens. I tell you, we had about 2,500 people about to arrive on the website. You know, everyone had been scheduled to come in, and you know, they'd made space in their busy work days to do this for 10 minutes, and it just wasn't there. And I was not happy.
You're like, hey, come check this thing out. See what we're going on with over here.
Yeah.
So after that, we kind of automated it a little bit better.
Yeah, I'm not a harsh taskmaster. You know, just sometimes where you know, you can call the paramedics. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now I'm hoping that more developers start to follow suit in the near future and really just get a better understanding of how the cloud and technology works, and really the fact that you can offload what was previously like right in front end bound work. Right, I mean, not all the processing has to be done on the client side. You can handle everything on the server and spit it back out as necessary. So. I look at what you're doing really as like, you know, trend setting and setting the difference, because like you said, you know, you want a freelancer type of experience, but 14 years ago it just wasn't possible. But now we do have the technology, and it's great to see your studio kind of paving the way for developers to kind of follow the lead and make that childhood experience kind of come to life now as adults.
God, I should hire you as my copywriter. That's a brilliant line for an advert.
No, it's true though. I grew up playing games too. Especially on like PC, and this kind of thing just wasn't possible. I mean, hell, even playing StarCraft 1, which I still played up until a couple of years ago.
Mm.
If you have more than if you have three people on each side, the game comes to a complete halt after 15 or 20 minutes. So I think the fact that we can fast forward 14 years later and have this, you know, is kind of mind blowing.
Well, thank you. We completely agree with you. I think we are setting a hopefully what people will look back and say that was a bit of a benchmark. I'm sure everyone, you know, lots of people will do it better than us and faster than us, and you know, in the future, and that's cool. Yeah. But I think we'll probably be first out there with a sort of just a new genre, a new kind of experience.
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated to see what it's going to actually play like. You know, what will a 50,000 playership battle feel like to be in? You know, what will, you know, how will Alliance fleet management work? You know, how is everyone going to be babbling on TeamSpeak or Ventrilo, or hopefully in their browser in real time chat? You know,
get WebRTC in IE, so
yeah, IE is doing great. So you know, it's going to be really interesting, even just to see how the players interact with it. You know, from a sort of psychosocial perspective. You know,
yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, how can players get their hands on this when it is finally out the door? Will they pay, you know, one price up front? Is it like a freemium game? What was the type of model?
Free to play. Our current title, Illyriad's free to play. Free to play gets usually quite fairly a bad press, because most free to play games are, you know, they're pay to play, and they're out there. They're designed to strip as much money off players as fast as possible, and they're designed to be disposable. But Illyriad, our current title, is, you know, coming out, as I say, up to 5 years old, and that's a persistent world. And we still have players playing it today who have played it for 5 years.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not letting too many cats out of the bag when I say only about 22% of our players monetize. You know, the majority of our players, more than three quarters of them, never pay us a penny. And that's fine. We're cool with that, because we don't allow pay to win. You know, we can't have a situation with a persistent game where a guy arrives with a big credit card and on week three he's, you know, killing the veterans who've been playing for 5 years.
Right.
That just doesn't work. So, you know, so we do free to play without pay to win, essentially.
Yeah. And I mean, some games can pull it off. I think successfully have pulled it off. And one that comes to mind is Team Fortress 2, right? They went from a premium model where you had to actually buy the game up front to now 5 years later, it was free to play. And I don't play it nearly as much as I used to, but every Halloween, like clockwork, because of the holiday events, I go back, because they can dynamically update it, right? They can add new maps and characters and weapons. And what people are paying never comes to mind because they're buying largely cosmetic items or weapons that are the equivalent of what I have, but just a different way of handling them, right? So it's all about preference.
Yeah, absolutely. It's about preference and utility. We're not going to be selling gold ammo, you know, special missiles that will insta-kill things. That's never going to happen. Because it's self-defeating for everyone involved, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, you're not going to get a game with longevity out of that. And we, you know, our sort of game design focus is on the grand, epic, sweeping strategy. It's not on the short-term disposable game.
Right. You want to have people around for the long run, try to make really good value for what you're doing there.
Absolutely. And we value our players. Obviously, you know, we love the players who pay us money. You know, that keeps bread on the table and keeps the servers running. But we also love players who contribute just by playing the game and talking in chat and being helpful to newbies and, you know, or running an alliance or being the villains of the piece. I mean, every game needs a villainous alliance as well. It can't all be kittens and sunshine.
Yeah, definitely. Because they're providing service to both you and the players alike, right?
They're providing content. Alive. Absolutely. They're providing content. They're providing enmities and jealousies and loves and hatreds and rallying cries and an active forum, lots of players talking about the game, lots of players
thinking about it when they're at work.
Absolutely.
And they can't play at work, so they're answering forums and can't wait till they can get home.
We love that. I mean, you know, we've had a couple of alliances sort of printing, you know, writing, you know, 2,000-word charters of peace treaties and diplomatic arrangements. You know, one guy started a newspaper, the Illyriad Free Times or something. You know, that kind of stuff we just love, you know, because it shows that the players have got a deep emotional investment in a world that they've created. You know, we've kind of built the toolbox for them to use, but they themselves are actually creating a large chunk of the content in it.
Mm-hmm. So it's up to them to kind of create it from there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now we're kind of coming to an end here. I do have a couple last few questions for you.
Mm.
I know your team is pretty dispersed. What's it like managing people across three different continents?
Oh, it's great. Imagine if Ben had been in the same room as me when the servers had 5 minutes to go and they weren't ready. He wouldn't have made it out alive.
Yeah, someone thought
that out, right? Sorry, I probably should say that. No, it actually worked fine. And there are pros and cons to it. The pros are you have the whole world as your recruitment pool, so you can always find the right person, you know, wherever they are, and that's great.
So it's not a limitation of saying, hey, do you want to move to whatever city we're located in, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Relocating families is not an easy thing.
Yeah, so, you know, we've got people, you know, we had one of our art team, I'm here in Florida, Ben's in the UK, Nathan, our art director, is in Tennessee, our community manager's in Texas, we've got people all over the place, and that's really cool. And we use freelancers a lot as well, because, you know, again, it's quite cost effective.
Exactly.
If you find the right freelancers, the downside of it is that you have to find people who are self starters, and that can be difficult because not everyone is suited to working from home.
Right.
You know, there are some people who really do work best in an office environment. Mm-hmm. And, that's just something you have to find out when you bring people on board, really.
No like check mark above their head that says yes, great at working from home.
Yeah, absolutely. And we use Skype a lot, and you know, we use Google Hangouts and Google Chat and all the sort of the standard tools.
Yeah, Google Hangouts are great for keeping people in touch.
They are, and you know, in a strange way, I think we probably talk more often than we would if we were in the same building sometimes, because you know, when you're in you want to be able to have the time to sit down and work on something uninterrupted for a bit and ignore your emails.
Exactly.
And also it means that when we do talk, we've got things to talk about. There's no point in having a conversation just for the sake of having the conversation. So, you know, it sort of creates a bit more of a structure, really. Also creates more documentation. You know, there tends to be more email chains and more things written down, which is, you know, helpful with
that's right. Oh yeah, that's the truth, especially with programming. You want constant notes and comments behind.
Well, except when I'm writing the code, in which case it's just it's, you know, this
that code is not self documenting.
My code's not even self running most of the time.
Okay, so the way I close out every show now is I take a question that the previous guest had asked. And then immediately afterwards, I'm going to ask that you provide a question for the next guest as well. So You have two minds to bounce off of each other, so you have a little bit easier than others, I think. So with that in mind, are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Shoot. So from last week, developer Steve Sefchik from Nimbus Games, he asked, is it important to spend as much time playing games as you do making them, and why?
Ooh. Probably not as much time playing them as... you should certainly spend a lot of time playing games, and it's really important. I've actually found it quite difficult since you know, obviously this is my first job in the games industry, and this is our first company, so I don't have a vast experience of it. But I kind of think it's like being a chef. You know, chefs are notorious for being the worst eaters in the world, because they come home from work at 2 a.m, exhausted, and it's whatever they can eat with one hand, you know, from the fridge. And I kind of find, for me anyway, I do get that a bit, because when I play games now, I either get angry with them because they're badly designed, in my opinion, or I get angry with them because they're so well designed it makes me cry.
Yeah, yeah. Or you start to notice every little bug inside of them as well.
Well, every little bug, but also every like, oh wow, God, I wish we could have done it that way, or you know, we'll never get a soundtrack as good as awesome as this.
Yeah, it's a gift and a curse, right?
It's a gift and a curse, and so I find when I do play games, I find it quite hard to enjoy them, which is sad, you know. Mm. I guess it's like having a degree in English or something, you know, a specialization, and then trying to reread the works of Shakespeare.
Right. Kind of, and the other catch is you kind of get that sense of guilt when you're playing games and you're thinking in the back of your mind, this is time I could be spent making something. So,
Yeah, no, absolutely right. That's true. Ben, would you agree or are you different?
I'd sort of agree. I mean, I've got a long history of playing games.
Anything in particular that stands out to you?
Well, I started on the TI Texas Instruments, CRS-81, I think, and then Spectrum, Amiga. But, I mean, it's Civilization. It's sort of the things you went through before.
Yeah, yeah. You know what is I had a bunch of guests on from the UK. I mean, your gaming scene there is massive compared to what we have in many cities across the country in the US. But I read a lot of Retro Gamer magazine, and they're all based out of the UK. And just the consoles and devices you were using in the 80s are far, far different from what we had in the States, in that we were very much dominated by, first, the NES, and then, second, Sega Master System, and towards the mid and late 80s, before Genesis and Super NES came about. But I noticed in the UK, I mean, you had the Marty, you had FM Town's Marty, you had Commodore, Amiga,
devices,
plus what we had in the States.
Yeah, the Spectrum, the
Archimedes. Commodore 64 was great. The Acorn Archimedes, that was a beast. Remember Zarch? That was a great game.
That was a great game.
They were talking gibberish to the Americans.
There was a competitor to the Amiga. I can't remember what it was. But maybe that's why it's different, because we were brought up, they were all computers, so rather than consoles, so you could write programs for them. So maybe that's why there's a slightly different belief in the games developers. But I came late to the making games when James snapped me up.
So neither of you had worked on a game before,
Never.
Impressive.
But from that point of view, with that history, so I have played a lot of games.
Yes.
My current view is no, you shouldn't play that too much games. I think it's important to dabble for like impressions and ideas.
Oh, I should get sidetracked.
And then you get that sort of imagination, and you can sort of see where it's going. And that's almost more powerful, that impression. Because I remember the Civilization tech tree being this vast thing.
Yeah.
And in Illyriad, that's sort of driven us, and we have more than 400 research items in the tree and all this sort of stuff. And then looking back at Civilization, they've only got 74, and it's like, whoa.
Maybe we went a little too far here.
Well, so in part, it's that comparison to your imagination that makes you strive harder and further.
Yeah, definitely. It's that nostalgia coming back to bite you.
Yeah. So I see that, like, dabbling with the games opens you to the possibility, but if you play too much of it, you sort of get exposed to their limits, and there's a danger that you accept them as your own. You see what I mean? You don't. It's good to get the impression of them and to follow the ideas and see where it could go. But if you just keep playing the same game, then you think exactly like how that game works, if you see what I mean. And you sort of almost get siloed into it.
Well said. I like it. I like it. So, do you have a question, either of you, for the next developer who will be on the show?
Yeah, I've got one. If there was one game you wish you had written, what would it be and why?
What would it be and why?
Yeah, any game, any era, any platform, anything, what would it be and why?
I know it is for me, but I'm going to save that for the next guest who comes on. Yeah, that's a good question. I like it. So, gentlemen, in closing, is there any final remarks you'd like to say? And how can people get in touch with you? How can they find you, your work, whether through Twitter or website or whatever is your choice?
Yeah, the website, www.ageofascent.com. Twitter is at Age of Ascent. We got a forum there, and we've got our playtest, and that's really the thing I'd say. You know, if you are interested in what we're doing and you want to see how it works and all the rest of it, just, you know, it's free every Saturday. I think it's at 3 o'clock Central US time, 3 p.m. Yeah. Just drop in every second Saturday and just turn up with a web browser, and you'll be sucked into the world of Age of Ascent and be prepared to be killed. There are some very, very, very talented pilots out there who come back every week and, you know, usually hunt down and kill me or Ben, because that it's fun to kill the devs, I think. So, yeah.
And Ben, how about yourself? Do you have a personal Twitter handle or a website or anything like that?
Yeah, at Ben_A_Adams on Twitter. But yeah, you can contact us through Age of Ascent or Illyriad on Twitter, and we'll get those two.
Awesome, I like it.
Cool. Oh, yeah, my personal Twitter is at JNeesOne. But, you know, it's always pointless saying that because it's impossible to spell NeesOne.
Yeah, yeah. Even beforehand, I'd ask. That's right. What's going on here? Well, thank you again, gentlemen, for hopping on the show. I'd love to have you back on in a follow-up episode once the game's actually released, so we can kind of compare notes, see what we had hoped for now and what the end result was then, and as well as understanding how Azure and WebGL both evolved together, too.
Yeah, it's been great, Dave. Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again, and I will see you the next time.